But at the same time, I think we're really battling this sensation in the visual journalism world that people are so inundated with imagery. You know, we consume more photographs now than we ever have before. And I think we have become so desensitized to images of suffering and pain and death and famine, that it takes something colossal or something just different to get us to stop and actually pay attention.
How's it going, everyone? Welcome back to episode 8 of the Austin Meyer Podcast. I'm your host, Austin Meyer. I'm a National Geographic explorer and documentary filmmaker. And on this podcast, I interview the world's best storytellers about how they craft the stories they tell. These are storytellers in all sorts of genres: writers, filmmakers, photographers, musicians, artists, and any other medium where people use storytelling to make a positive impact in the world. This week on the show, I'm honored to welcome Daniela Zaltzman. Daniela is a documentary photographer based between London and New York. She is a multiple grantee of the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, a fellow with the International Women's Media Foundation, and the founder of Women Photograph, an initiative working to elevate the voices of female and non-binary visual journalists. Her ongoing project, Signs of Your Identity, is the recipient of many awards, including the 2017 Arnold Newman Prize and a 2017 Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award. Daniela's work tends to focus on the legacies of Western colonization, from the rise of homophobia in East Africa to the forced assimilation education of indigenous children in North America. That theme of colonization is on display in one of Daniela's most recent projects on Native American imagery and identity, which is featured in this month's issue of National Geographic magazine. In this conversation, Daniela and I talk about how and why she made the jump from hard news photography to longer-term, longer-form documentary projects, how she uses unconventional techniques like double exposure to tell complex stories, and photography's potential in elevating the voices of those who have been oppressed. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Daniela Zaltzman. Cool. All right. Well, Daniela Zaltzman, thank you so much for joining the podcast. It's an honor to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. All right. So I'd love to start by having you talk a little bit about what your background is in photography, and maybe we could talk a little bit about your first job working in tabloid news as a photographer in New York City. How did that job come about?
So I don't really have a background in photography per se. I've wanted to be a journalist since I was probably about 12 years old. But for a while, that more took the form of writing. I always wanted to work for newspapers, and I intentionally worked really hard to go to college in New York City because I figured that's sort of the heart of the U.S. media empire, and I just wanted to be there for the ability to be near potential job and internship opportunities. And the first thing I did when I got to college was I joined the Columbia student newspaper. Mm-hmm. And started spending most of my time there. Wasn't a very good student. The college newspaper became more of my major than what I was actually studying, which was architecture. Mm-hmm. And pretty early on, a friend of mine who was the then photo editor, I started out as a reporter and as a associate news editor, and a friend of mine who was the photo editor had a crisis, I think around this time. It was Thanksgiving holiday, everyone was busy, no one wanted to take a photo assignment, and John Ashcroft was coming to campus, and so he asked me if I would grab a camera and go shoot, and I did, and I just completely fell in love with the medium. So
did you have any idea what you were doing that first time?
I had shot casually on point-and-shoot digital cameras in high school, I think, in the way that people our generation did, but not really. I mm-hmm. had barely used SLRs. I knew nothing technical about digital photography. I was completely making it up as I went along. But it was fun and different, and I really loved it. So I sort of drifted more and more into that side of things. The college newspaper And then by sheer coincidence, I ended up getting this assignment with the New York Daily News because the then president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, came to speak on campus and security was very tight and most local media outlets weren't permitted to send someone to cover him. So the Daily News actually called the newspaper office and I happened to be the photographer around. So I ended up shooting for them. It was the front page of the newspaper the next day. And I started freelancing for them on a very regular basis.
Wow. So in that moment where you mentioned you picked up a camera, you started shooting for that first time and you kind of connected with it. Do you remember what about it struck you as something that you really enjoyed?
You know, I don't. And it honestly, it was pretty much the most boring situation you can imagine in the context of news photography. It was, you know, a man at a podium for a speaking engagement. So, you know, it wasn't exactly a riveting spot news photography. But I just remember that it felt like a different, more immediate form of storytelling. And I really liked that shift.
Yeah. And so when you started, you worked for the Daily News, what kind of assignments were you working on in those days?
It was a huge range. And I think that's what I really appreciate about that background, even though I don't do work even approaching that anymore, nor do I really want to, but I am glad that I have this basis in metro New York City photography, where, you know, initially I was doing a lot of very tabloidy hard news, so a lot of crime scenes and fires, you know, getting calls at all hours from the photo desk, partially because of where I was located. I was based in Morningside Heights in Harlem, so, you know, I was covering the South Bronx a lot and Upper Manhattan, and then ended up shooting quite a bit of fashion for some reason, which is something I am completely ill-equipped to do. But, you know, as a news photographer, you have to do everything. And so I would shoot a little sports. And I think one of my earliest assignments for the Daily News was shooting a Springsteen concert at the Meadowlands. And I ended up doing a lot of features as well. And I think that was sort of a natural division that happens a lot at newspapers, is that women sometimes get pushed into doing the fun, soft features, which I, you know, honestly enjoyed. It was a good way for me to get to know New York. But yeah, it was a little bit of everything. And I did really love that.
Were you working mostly on like hourly and daily deadlines? And, was that giving you a chance to get a lot of reps? And one of the reasons I asked is because, you know, I started out doing video journalism when I graduated from school. I started at the LA Times and I was doing videos and I wasn't really connecting to the stories, but one of the things that I was always thinking to myself as an intern there was that I'm just churning out so many pieces that those reps were going to be really great for building my skills. And were you kind of in the same scenario there?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I loved about the Daily News is that it, especially then, I think it may have changed somewhat, but back then it really was a small town paper in the biggest city in America. And so I was just as often covering the outer boroughs and far Queens and Brooklyn and the Bronx and Staten Island as I was Manhattan. So it was really, you know, I agree with you about feeling like you're not really connecting to the stories because, you know, at most you get, what, 15 minutes to 3 hours to work on a piece.
Right.
And for me in particular, this was at a point where I didn't really know who I was as a documentarian, but I realized after several years of that, that, you know, my strength is I'm a very empathetic person. I'm very good with people. I have a knack for sitting down with someone and getting them to just pour out their entire life story. Mm. You don't get as much freedom to do that when you're meeting someone for, you know, 2 hours. Mm. And so that's what eventually sort of drove me towards more long form storytelling. But I did appreciate, you know, the versatility I had to learn, the speed I had to learn. You know, I ended up moving to the Wall Street Journal after a few years, and I just remember all of my editors being shocked at how quickly I filed photos. It was just like, what do you
nice.
Mean? You have to. That's I didn't have a choice. So, you know, it just taught me a skill set that, you know, isn't maybe a priority for me now, but I'm grateful for that grounding.
Mm-hmm. And so how did you make the jump into the long-term social documentary projects that you're doing now?
When I was in New York, I think I always set aside about a month of the year to just go and explore something different, usually outside of the U.S. And so, you know, it was working really hard and would save up and, you know, would try to pitch, but obviously, you know, a 24-year-old photographer with absolutely no background in international reporting is not going to get assignments or work picked up. But I, for whatever reason, was drawn to East Africa. In 2011, I went for the independence of South Sudan for a month and spent some time in that region, and sort of through a series of coincidences ended up on and off for the next few years documenting the anti-gay law that went through parliament in Uganda, and sort of looking at the rise of homophobia in East Africa and how that's a product of Western colonization. So that was sort of my first foray into really long-term reporting and becoming embedded in a community and forming these long-term connections. Realized that that's what I wanted to be doing. I didn't totally know how to make that work financially or logistically, but yeah. I knew that that's what I wanted to move towards in some way.
Gotcha. And were you getting grant funding for that first project?
So the very first trip I took, where I went to South Sudan and then ended up in Uganda, sort of on my way in and out of the country, that was all self-funded. And I put a lot of money into that trip and did not make very much of it back. But the next trip I took happened, you know, not too long after that. Uganda actually passed the anti-gay bill, and I'd been in that community, and I had reached out to people a couple years earlier and had stayed in close contact with several of the leading activists there. So then when there was actually this news hook and suddenly it was something that was sort of appealing on a more international stage, I reached out to the Pulitzer Center and said, hey, I have all the contacts I need. I'm ready to go and report this. I just need a little funding to go and spend 3 weeks there. And so that was sort of what started my relationship with the Pulitzer Center and how I started shifting towards getting grant funding to work.
Mm, okay, nice. So I'm really interested in the project that I've been working on most of this year, which was with one of my first grants that I got with the National Geographic Young Explorer Program. I was doing a project on maternal health in Zambia. And I'm interested to hear from your project that you worked in Uganda. I did a lot of thinking about, like, at what point do I bring a camera into the lives of the people whose story I'm hoping to tell? And I'm wondering how you navigated that, either when you were working for the Daily News in New York and when you were going into communities there, or when you were going into these communities in Uganda focusing on LGBT rights. I guess how did you think about, when do I bring the camera into this situation to tell the story in the most authentic way possible?
Well, I think I had an easier job than what you were doing, because I was ostensibly dealing with a community of activists. It's sort of a complicated, impossible distinction, because in a country like Uganda, especially in around 2011 when I started working there, you basically couldn't be an out LGBTQ person and not be an activist. That, you know, you could not be out and not spend your entire existence justifying who you were and fighting for the right to be who you were. So, you know, I was working with this community of, you know, there were maybe 12 out gay people in the entire country who also functioned as the sort of leading core group of activists. And for people who are working within a social movement, a huge part of what they are working towards is visibility, is, you know, being able to destigmatize and demystify something just through being around and proving that you're normal and you deserve the same rights as everyone else. So, you know, now I'm working in a lot of communities where people are much more likely to be suspicious and closed off and don't necessarily want a camera or a photographer there. And so that becomes a different set of considerations and negotiations. But it was always very easy and very natural in Uganda, because they wanted me there. They wanted someone to be helping them tell those stories. And they were getting a fair amount of international press coverage, but I think I was working as a photographer in a different way from a lot of other people, and I was also one of the few people who was coming back regularly. So it gave me a different perspective and different access.
Gotcha. Is there a project you've been working that you're currently working on, or you've been working on lately that you felt that kind of what I'm referring to as that time you need to build up trust and keep the cameras out of the room for the first couple times you meet them?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, in general, I think that I try to do that anyway, because I think it's hugely important. And I try to stress this with young photographers that, you know, the work is second, that both genuinely caring about people and getting them to understand that you care about them as humans is your number one responsibility in any context. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my sort of longest ongoing project is looking at the survivors of coercive assimilation boarding schools for Indigenous children. Primarily, I've been working in the U.S., Canada, and Australia, and that has, you know, especially as a non-Indigenous journalist, that has taken a huge amount of trust building. Mm. And then I've also, you know, I've been photographing the Syrian family now for about 3 years, and now I am basically their adopted daughter, and so it's very easy. But at the beginning, I met one of, it's a family of six children who all went on the refugee trail and ended up in different parts of the EU. Mm-hmm. And the first time I met the first son was in that horrible refugee camp in Calais. And yeah, you know, that absolutely, he was very warm and welcoming. And I don't think it would have actually taken me all that much careful negotiation, but it still is important to me for mm-hmm. people to understand that I'm spending time with them, not just because the work matters to me, but because people matter to me.
And when you go back and maybe you've done like a long-term project like that, and you look at your photographs from, you know, your first week shooting versus, you know, year two or three shooting with somebody, in what ways, like, how do you describe how your photography changes over that time as the trust has been built?
Well, I think it just, you know, it's both emotionally becomes deeper and more complex, and then also situationally, you know, you're allowed in and given access to things that you might not have the first time. Mm. And even for the most naturally open people, you know, I've been photographing this trans man and his family this year, and he is also a photographer, and so we had a conversation early on about what it would be like for me to photograph them, because they've got a really unique but kind of beautiful family story, and I think there are unfortunately not a lot of stories about trans people that center joy and sort of ordinary family life. And so I wanted to photograph. I spent a lot of time photographing really dark things, and so I, you know, that was my happy story for 2018. And we were extremely open about it, and he understands because he's a photographer, and you know, they were pretty willing for me to do anything I wanted. But even still, the first time I went, you know, there are situations where you feel yourself as a documentarian that it's inappropriate, or you can sense that the other person is maybe slightly uncomfortable. And I returned last month to photograph him again, not having intended only to go once and just to do a quick story. And then he decided that he was going to get top surgery. And so I returned because I happened to be nearby in October. And that, you know, that whatever little wall existed between us was totally gone. And so I think, you know, even if it's unintentional, I think, you know, we keep our guard up. It's a complicated thing to allow a near stranger unfettered access to your life like that, especially when you know that this is then going to be broadcast to the greater world.
Yeah.
And so just sometimes time is the most important thing that changes the way you interact with someone.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about those first long-term projects really captivated you and made you feel like, this is the path that I want to take my career? I don't want to return to the daily news, the hard news.
It's a combination of, you know, again, just having the time and the editorial freedom. You know, it was not just I had more than a day to work on a story. It was also, I was determining what stories I worked on instead mm-hmm. of having a photo editor call me in the morning and say, hey, you're going to place X and you're photographing person Y and this is the story. So, you know, I very much enjoy that I get to determine now what issues I'm covering and why. And I also increasingly, I consider myself a photojournalist, but my work is increasingly non-traditional in the sort of formats and techniques that I use. And I can only really do that if I'm working in a slow, independent way. So I rely on that grant funding to give me both the creative and the editorial freedom to work on the projects that I want in the way that I want.
Yeah. What's one of those techniques or formats that you've been experimenting with over the years that you feel you couldn't do as a hard news journalist?
I use multiple exposure a lot in an editorial capacity. I started using it in Uganda when I was photographing these activists who completely were willing to be photographed, but at the same time, there was a lot of risk involved, and a lot of Ugandan newspapers were on a regular basis stealing images from Western news outlets and the wire services and then running them on the front pages in their newspapers under headlines like, you know, hang the homos. There was a lot of moral pressure to figure out, okay, how do I not be paternalistic? And if people are telling me they want to be photographed, I need to respect that. But how do I also make sure that I'm making sure that people are safe? And so I started taking double exposure portraits of the Ugandan activists I was photographing as a way to, you know, still allow them to be visible. You could still read their faces, but it didn't feel like something that was ever going to be stolen. And to date, that I know of, they have not. And then this project that I'm currently working on, that I will be working on for a very long time, looking at the history of Indian boarding schools, is a history that sort of peaked in the mid-20th century, but is very much still a part of Native identity and trauma today. And so figuring out how to photograph something that is rooted in the past and in memory and in ideas like intergenerational trauma and cultural genocide. You know, how do you photograph something like that that goes beyond just here is a portrait of a person who experienced this thing?
Right.
I decided that I wanted to work in multiple exposure, overlaying the portraits of boarding school survivors with the actual sites of where they had attended school.
And so, yeah, for the listeners who might not be familiar with the double exposure term, can you describe just briefly what that is?
Yeah, it's a composite. Double exposure, I guess, in a classic sense, refers to in camera, the overlaying of two images. You know, back when we were using film photography, that you would actually shoot multiple images onto the same negative. In digital photography, sometimes it can be more intentional, which is what I do. But I'm essentially overlaying two photographs into one. Mm-hmm.
And why can't that really work in hard news or in daily news? why can't that work?
Well, it's funny, it's changing. When I was doing that work in Uganda, I remember pitching some of those images to mainstream news outlets in the US, and photo editors would be like, oh, that's nice, that's fun, but no, we're not, that's not for us. And that's changed a lot since then. In just the past, 7 or 8 years, my Signs of Your Identity work, the work on the boarding school survivors, that's been published in a lot of mainstream news outlets, from The New Yorker to CNN to National Geographic. So the fundamental problem is that people look at it and say, okay, well, this isn't journalism because this isn't just a straight news photograph that represents how we see. Which in many respects is our metric for what is journalism, right? And I think that's a completely fair definition, and I respect people who argue that my work is not journalism. That's their right to say that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think we're really battling this sensation in the visual journalism world that people are so inundated with imagery. You know, we consume more photographs now than we ever have before, and I think we have become so desensitized to images of suffering and pain and death and famine, that it takes something colossal or something just different to get us to stop and actually pay attention. And so for me, that was, I think the fun of a composite image is that it it plays a trick on your brain where it really does force you to look and try to resolve what exactly is going on. You kind of have to look and say, okay, wait, there's this thing and then there's this thing, and you sort of, it slows you down in a very intentional way. And so for me, that was sort of the path in to get people to engage with the story that they otherwise might have just breezed past.
Right, yeah, where they might have just, you know, seen another image of suffering and felt like, I don't want to engage with this, I just want to keep moving. But in your double exposures, it's almost like a puzzle in some ways, because your eyes don't know where at first to glance. And then in the way that stories are told through those double exposures, how do you decide what images to place over another images? Like, how do you think about the interplay of those two images in the way that you tell the story?
They're very intentional, and I only use composites in an editorial capacity if there is a real reason for it. It's not just sort of an art effect that I employ at whim. But it's, you know, for Signs of Your Identity, it was very much about this notion of why things are capable of staying with us for so long, and not just with us as individuals, but things, you know, trauma that gets passed on to our children. And I think it's a concept that we've really only, in either a social or a scientific way, have begun to understand and discuss. And, you know, we're starting to see that the descendants of Holocaust survivors actually have trauma encoded into their DNA, and, you know, descendants of slavery, and, you know, there are all of these things that get passed on. And so for me, that was one of the reasons to use a sort of layered image, was to talk about those issues. And so the secondary photographs they're usually pretty literal. They're often, I would go to the sites where these individuals had actually gone to boarding school. Sometimes they're a little more metaphorical, but yeah. they're really meant to represent their experience and their memories.
That's really interesting. I want to try some in my own photography. All right, so I'd love to move to your National Geographic story, which is out in the December issue. I encourage everyone to check it out. So I saw in one of your Instagram story highlights, you called this story a crazy, incredible, totally terrifying process. And I would love to hear about that process on your story of the misrepresentation of Native Americans in the U.S. From the pitch to actually getting out into the field and photographing this amazing story.
Sure. It was a really complicated process. And I think, you know, any story that you work on for a year in collaboration with a publication is naturally going to be complicated and difficult. But, you know, this was something that I started thinking about a lot as I've worked on Signs of Your Identity. I've been in dozens of Native communities in North America. And the more I worked in Native communities, the more I was noticing and realizing just how prevalent Indigenous imagery is in North America, but almost always in a context that is controlled or created by non-Native people. You know, I grew up in the D.C. area, the home of the Washington Redskins, and as a kid, I never really questioned that. I never really thought about that word and what it meant. When I pitched the story to Geographic, one of the first places that I went to was Cleveland to follow the Indians, because they had just announced that they were phasing out Chief Wahoo. And it was just really remarkable to me to think about this particular form of racism that we have made completely acceptable in the United States. You know, if you sub in any other ethnic group for the representations of Native Americans that we continue to see throughout this country, it would be wildly unacceptable. You know, whether it's the commercialization of Native identity or mascotry, or it's all rooted in racism. And somehow, because it is a very small subset of the population, we've just decided that we get to keep doing that, and it's okay.
And so did you, when you pitched this story to National Geographic, had you already started working on the project, or is this something where you're like, I have this idea, and are you in?
I hadn't explicitly started working on it. I think it's, you know, it's something, my phone at this point is probably my primary camera. It's the camera that I use for Signs of Your Identity. And I, you know, I sort of consider my Instagram in many ways as my primary platform. It's how I engage with people and talk about my work. So I, for a long time, I'd been sort of sharing thoughts and images around this notion. But I wanted to do something a little more structured and a little broader. I'd shot one piece for a small online outlet called Topic about a year ago that specifically looked at high school sports teams with native themed mascots in Ohio, which happens to be the state with the highest number of native mascots. And so I've been looking at it piecemeal here and there, but the great thing about Geographic is that it's really one of the only publications left where you can say, hey, I would like to spend 6 months wandering around the United States working on this one thing. And so that's what I came to them with.
And so how did you choose what, like where you wanted to go to photograph this? You did take photos of a number of schools that have the mascots. But how did you decide where in the country you wanted to photograph this story?
Well, I was trying to make sure that it was as geographically diverse as possible, that it was diverse in subject matter, that I was looking at, you know, athletics and, athletics and at spirituality and representation in commercial logos. And, you know, I was just trying to cover as many different genres as possible. And then within that, also make sure that I was, you know, covering sort of an acceptably broad cross-section of the United States, that I wasn't just looking at the Southwest or, you know, the Northeast. So, you know, it's just trying to balance all these things and make sure that I was covering my bases.
Gotcha. And when you would go into places to photograph, how would you explain what you were doing to those who you were photographing?
I was honest. I mean, you know, I think it's an important conversation, and particularly for people who are working with kids, it's an important conversation that we have with our children, because if you just normalize a lot of these representations, then kids grow up not understanding that maybe this is something that deserves a conversation or a second look. So, you know, I may not have explicitly used the word appropriation when I was sort of introducing the project, but, you know, I would talk about, look, what is the representation of Native Americans look like in this country, and who has had that power? Who has been in control of that image? And so, you know, representation and appropriation exist on a spectrum. Obviously, there are some things that are just flat out horrible and inappropriate and racist, and some things that are a little more grayscale that, you know, for instance, the work that I do as a non-Native person in Native communities is definitely on some level questionable. But trying to figure out what those lines are and who gets to decide and how we have those conversations at all, I think is really important. Mm.
So you traveled all over the country. As your Instagram story said, you shot over 61,000 photos.
Yep.
Which is amazing. In that time, what was one of the biggest challenges for you as a photographer telling the story through photos, or for you personally, just working on this project over a long period of time?
I think with anything that broad, it's just making sure that you stay focused and that you have a sort of coherent narrative thread that is going through your work that is the most important. And it was also, you know, I won't get into the entire editorial process. There was sort of another half of the project that was developing as well, about looking at Native Americans who were taking control of their own narratives and sort of restoring their own identity in mainstream American spaces. And so I was also balancing working on that with working on this appropriation story. But it's a lot to juggle. It's a lot to try to keep clear. And so it was really important that I had a great relationship with my photo editor. And, you know, we would speak almost every single day trying to say, okay, how does this piece fit in? And what are we missing? And what are the things that we need to make sure that we incorporate?
Right. And then when you're going out and photographing, is the writer of the story, are they involved with all those conversations as well? Do they come in at the end once you have all your photos? Because I really thought in the story I read that the written word communicated really nicely and complemented the photography and vice versa. So I'm wondering how that process works with your photos working in tandem with the writing.
You know, there are a lot of publications where photographers will work side by side with the writer and they'll be together at all times. And that has been my experience more in newspapers. For Geographic, it's almost completely separate. You know, I know both of the writers who wrote the two pieces that went into the magazine, but I mm-hmm. never actually was in the field with either of them at the same time. And partially, I think that's because Geographic really centers photography, and the magazine is much more about crafting the story through the photography than it is crafting it through the writing. But we were all allowed to sort of work in our own way, and we were all communicating, obviously, as a team throughout the entire process. But we all kind of did our own thing and then brought it all together, which I thought worked really well.
Interesting. And then you also mentioned in that Instagram story how the editing process for choosing the photos for this feature was unique. Can you describe how that was unique and what you think that lent the story, or what you think that offered the story that might not have worked otherwise?
Yeah, well, in, you know, almost any other editorial relationship, the photographer goes out and shoots thousands or tens of thousands of images. And then, you know, we get home and we dump our cards and we go through the images and we pick our selects and we file those to the photo editor, and the photo editor selects from that small subset of images what goes into the newspaper or magazine. With Nat Geo, you file every single photo you take while on assignment. So I would
say... So you like put them on a hard drive or...
Yeah. So you ship in hard drives every 2 weeks. So my photo editor looked at every single one of the 61,000 photos I took. And we sat down, you know, you come into the office at the midpoint of your story and at the end of your story, and you actually sit down for several days and look over all of your selects together and decide what's, you know, there are these shows that you put together for the staff of the magazine where you talk about the progress of the story and start to look at layout when you're there at the end of the story. And there are just all of these little steps that are quite collaborative, that sort of involve lots and lots of different people.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the images that would have been selected would have been wildly different if the process had been you sitting at home selecting images versus sending all of them to National Geographic?
I don't think wildly different. There were definitely a couple times where we didn't agree, but you know, it wasn't just, and again, sometimes the relationship between photo editor and photographer is it is a final call that the photo editor has to say, well, you're wrong, I like this photo, this is what's going to run. And often once you file your images, you don't know what's going to happen until it publishes. You often have zero insight into that intermediate process. And with this, you know, I knew exactly what was going to be in the magazine before it published. We had a conversation about every image and why it should be there or why it shouldn't be there.
So how did it feel to get the magazine in your hands and see your work in that magazine?
It was nice. It was a complicated, long process, and there were a lot of things that were pretty stressful about it. But in the end, I'm really glad that issue of the magazine incorporates the work of 8 Indigenous photographers, and it really is an attempt to be inclusive in how we're representing Native communities, because that's been a bit of a challenge for Geographic historically. It's almost entirely been sending white people to document Indigenous people and places. So it's I hope that this represents a real shift, and I'm really proud that I was part of it.
That's amazing. And transitioning on that topic of representation, you're the founder of Women Photograph, which is a platform dedicated to illuminating underrepresented voices as well. And I'd love if you could share how that idea came about, and then what's the state of Women Photograph and how that's influencing the industry of photographic storytelling.
I mean, it came about because it was a necessity. You know, we have ample evidence at this point. It's anecdotal, but ample evidence that shows us that about 15% of news photographers are women, which is really just pretty embarrassing at this point, that is how small a fraction of the community we make up. So, you know, I was getting to a point where I had more and more freedom within the industry because I don't really work on assignment much anymore. That Nat Geo story was really one of the first times in a while that I've worked closely with the publication. But because of that, because I mostly work based on grant funding, I kind of have a little more freedom to open my mouth and criticize people and speak up when I feel like things aren't functioning as they should. And it was really, you know, a couple years ago, I was just noticing in several large, important legacy outlets that they just weren't hiring women. And I would talk to photo editors about why that was continuing to happen in 2016. And they would tell me, well, you know, we would hire more women if we knew where to find them. And so, you know, from my cranky solutions oriented perspective, I just thought, fine, I'm just going to make a list. And then you don't have that excuse anymore. And so now Women Photograph is a database that includes almost 850 women, transgender, and non-binary visual journalists based in about 105 countries around the world.
That's amazing. And so is part of your job, or I guess whose job is it to kind of like get people aware that that exists? Like, were you going to editors and saying like, hey, just want to let you know, this is out there. No more excuses. And is it pretty widely adopted as a resource for newsrooms around the world?
I don't know about around the world. It's, you know, but I think my early goal, and this is almost certainly going to shift as we grow. But you know, I think the outlets that have the most money and the most power are largely Western outlets. So that was sort of my initial target audience, and that hasn't been difficult to reach. Whether or not those outlets believe that they have a responsibility to be hiring in more inclusive ways is a different story. But they know we're out there. They know we exist. And, you know, it's mostly social media at this point. And, you know, we were lucky to have support from, you know, the New York Times has written about us, and Time and Wired and Huffington Post. And, you know, a lot of different outlets have helped us sort of spread the word. And we are pretty proactive about curating exhibitions and just trying to elevate the visibility of the people in the database. And, you know, we have a lot of other secondary programs that we're working on as well. We have an annual grants program. I think to date distributed about $70,000 in funding.
Whoa.
We have a mentorship program. We have a travel fund. We collect our own data because I can yell all I want, but if it's not supported by hard numbers, it's not always very productive. So, you know, we look at a number of different statistics that sort of monitor the rates at which women are being hired and published in the industry. And I think I'm leaving one out, but yeah, you know, we're working on a number of different fronts to just create a shift.
Is there a story that you've seen that's been photographed by someone who was found through this platform where you thought, or where you felt proud because the story was told differently than maybe it would have been before? Like you felt like, wow, like this is what I'm talking about. This is why we need these voices. And the story was told in a different way because we had access to that.
Oh, all the time. And I honestly have lost count. But I mean, you know, I think the Me Too movement was an incredible example of, you know, we started, I both forget and I won't call out the specific publications, but, you know, during the Cosby news cycle, a lot of different outlets were hiring male photographers to photograph women who were survivors of sexual assault. And I don't think I need to explain why that's just not the best editorial decision. When you were talking to someone who has recently been traumatized, who is being re-traumatized by her experience in dealing with the news media, that, you know, sending a man into this environment is really just, from a fundamental sensitivity perspective, just seems like a bad decision. And, you know, looking at the difference from then to now, where, you know, almost every story that I see on the Me Too movement has been shot by a woman. You know, just having these conversations about why it matters who's behind the camera why it matters that we're being more inclusive and that we're including different perspectives in the group of storytellers that we employ. I think in general, and you know, that doesn't just cross gender, that's in terms of race and nationality and religion and sexual orientation and socioeconomic class. You know, I think we are slowly becoming more conscious of the fact that all of these things deeply impact how we work as photographers, as documentarians. So, you know, I have been able to see the change happen in the past couple of years, and it's not just because of Women Photograph, it's not just because of me, it's also Diversify Photo and the Everyday Projects and all of these other organizations that are working really hard to change what the news photography community looks like. But it's taken a lot of work.
Yeah. And you mentioned before that you're using Instagram as a platform. I know Women Photograph is using Instagram as a platform. In what ways has Instagram really changed the way that you can elevate these voices and elevate the reach of these stories?
It changes your audience. It changes how easily you can access the general public. You know, sort of pre-social media, the news outlets were the gatekeepers. They were the ones who had the audience. They were the places where you had to have your photography for it to be seen. And obviously, I still deeply believe in news media. I am still a journalist. I think newspapers and magazines are deeply important. But I also have, you know, my own personal audience of 60,000 people who I can engage with directly. And I can do that in more casual and more personal ways that I think are really lovely. And similarly with Women Photograph, you know, we've got something in the range of 75,000 followers, which is, you know, it's a higher number than the average newspaper has in circulation these days.
Wow.
So we're finding that the ways in which we can reach our audiences has shifted dramatically. And I really, obviously there are many moral, ethical problems with Instagram's parent company, Facebook, but in general, as a platform for photographers and for photography, I think that is just, it's been crucially important into democratizing how we can access and think about image making.
I love that. Okay, I think I have just two more questions. The first question is, what do you think photography can do as a storytelling medium that is unique to it? What is photography's unique power in telling a story?
It's immediate and it transcends any number of barriers that we have when we involve language. You know, I like, obviously, outlets like the BBC and a lot of major news organizations have the ability to work to translate text and radio and news, you know, television broadcast. But you don't have to do that with photography. You can reach everyone who can see. And you can do it automatically in an instant. And I think, you know, I'm maybe not a photojournalism purist in the sense that I deeply believe in the need for text to accompany photography and that captions are important and they provide history and context and that we really need those things. But the news photograph on its own is just so much more accessible than any other form of journalism to me. And so I think that's what makes it so important and so powerful.
And before my last question, if people want to follow your work, see more of what you're up to, what Women Photograph are doing, where should we be sending them here?
So for both Twitter and Instagram, my personal handles are D Zaltzman, DZALCMAN. And for Women Photograph, it's the same on both Twitter and Instagram. It's Women Photograph.
Go check it out, people. All right. And then the last question will just be any advice that you have to you young photographers. And I'm selfishly listening very closely to this one. You know, my focus is in documentary filmmaking, but I also, in the past year and a half, have really become I'm fascinated by documentary photography, and anyone out there who's just looking to get more involved in this and maybe start freelancing and getting some of their work published and out there, what advice would you have for them to start off their career?
I think two things I would say are, one, figure out what you care about. I think we spend a lot of time early on when we're trying to break into a field thinking about what editors want to see and what publications want to see and what the zeitgeist is demanding. And that's, in some ways, I think, slightly undermining the role of newspapers and magazines in mainstream society, is that we are so caught up in thinking about what our audiences want that we're not focusing on the stories that need to be told, whether or not they're sexy and palatable. So I think that for image makers and journalists in particular, thinking about the stories that matter to you and what you're drawn to covering and why is a really deeply important framework to get at. And it takes a long time to figure that out. You know, it took me years to understand that I was actually looking at the world through the lens of the legacies of colonization, because that's something that my mother beat into my head from an early age, because she is from Vietnam and that is very much part of her identity. But I think we all, as we have this conversation about who we are as image makers, why inclusivity and diversity is important, we're also realizing that we all give very different things to the documentary photography community. We all insert ourselves into our work, even if we are still trying to have this conversation about objectivity. You know, the truth is we deeply impact the photograph. And so I think understanding who you are and your viewpoint and your perspective is critical.
Amazing advice. Thank you so much for joining the podcast. This was amazing. I learned a lot, and I hope everyone enjoyed listening. Go check out all her work and her story in National Geographic. Danielle, thank you so much for joining the podcast today.
Thank you.
That's it for episode 8 of the Austin Meyer podcast. Thank you so much to Daniela for joining the show and to you for listening. If you're up for sharing your thoughts on today's episode, I would love to hear. Please send me a message on Instagram or Facebook at Austin Meyer Films or on Twitter at A Meyer Films. Meyer spelled M-E-Y-E-R. What was something that Daniela shared that really resonated with you or made you think differently about photography or storytelling? And if you enjoyed this episode, it would mean the world to me if you could share it with a friend or screenshot your phone and post it to your Insta story. It really helps spread the word about the show. So with that, I hope you have an amazing week. I'll see you back here next week for another episode of the Austin Meyer podcast. Go out and tell some stories.